didn't make any move to lower her, hostage to her luscious mouth nibbling at him, her wee hands clawing at his back.
"So, put me down, McKelter,"
she panted a few minutes later against his mouth, desperate to feel his skin against hers.
"I have too many clothes on."
"I'm trying,"
he said, trailing kisses down her neck and scraping his velvety tongue back up, only to arrive at her lips again, a position he could hardly fail to take full advantage of.
"Don't put me down,"
she whimpered when he stopped kissing her. Her lips felt naked and cold without him, her body bereft. The minute her toes touched the ground, she reached impatiently for his clothing, but he dived for her shorts at the same moment, cursing when he bumped his jaw on her head and she got tangled up in his hair. She fumbled with his hair, then found her way to the leather bands across his chest, but was unable to fathom how he'd fastened them. Brushing her hands aside, he tugged her shirt over her head, then stared at her bra. He touched the lacy fabric with fascination.
"Lass, show me your breasts. Be quit of this thing, lest I tear it to shreds in my haste."
She popped the front clasp swiftly and slipped it off. The cool air teased her nipples into puckered crests, and he drew a sharp inhalation of breath. For a moment, he didn't seem to be able to move, just stood and stared.
"You have splendid breasts, lass,"
he purred, cupping the plump mounds.
"Splendid,"
he repeated stupidly, and she almost laughed. Men loved breasts, any shape or form, they just loved them. And he was certainly loving hers. He palmed them, lifting and squeezing, and with a husky groan he buried his face in her breasts, rubbing back and forth before drawing a nipple deep into his mouth. Gwyn panted softly when he scattered scorching kisses over her breasts. She twisted and turned in his arms, wanting his mouth there, and there, and there, telling him with her body just how and where she needed him. His fingers worked at her shorts, with little success, and grunting his frustration, he tugged at her zipper, but succeeded only in jamming it off the track. Encountering similar resistance with his costume, she moaned frantically. She wanted skin against skin. She needed it. Every last inch, pressed slick and intimate.
"Oh, just do your own and I'll do mine,"
she snapped, impeded desire making her downright testy. She needed him naked now. He looked as relieved as she felt by the efficient solution, and as she tugged and twisted at her zipper, then kicked off her shorts, he removed his plaid, tossing knives left and right, doffing his axe and sword, and finally shucking his leather armor. He stood up straight, tossing his long dark hair over his shoulders, and looked at her.
"Christ, McKelter!"
Gwyn breathed, stunned. 6.5 feet of sculpted naked warrior stood before her, unself-conscious in his nudity. Proud, in fact, and well he should be. He was raw and male and powerful beyond compare, and it had certainly not been a sock or 20 in his jeans. He was breathtaking, and he had a remarkable amount of mass that she had not been factoring into her equation of why she was orbiting him, but she certainly would be in the future. It explained a great deal. His eyes drifted over her breasts, down her belly, then lit on her kitten thong, and he made a strangled sound.
I thought that was some strange ribbon to restrain your hair. 'Twas why I put it on your palate that night, thinking you might plait it before you slept. But, oh, lass, I far prefer it there,
he said roughly.
'Tis wise you did not tell me that was beneath your trews, for I would have walked around hard all day thinking of removing it with my tongue.
He likes my thong,
she thought, beaming. She'd always known that if she'd picked the right man to pluck her cherry, he would appreciate her good taste. Slipping to his knees before her, he proceeded to do as he'd threatened, lifting the strap of her thong away from the smooth curve of her hip with his teeth and licking the sensitive skin beneath it. He tugged the silk down with little nips, curving his tongue beneath it. She dug her fingers into his shoulders as he licked again and again, building resonance beneath her skin. He sucked her sensitive nub through the silk, making her arch against him, begging for more. Each inch he bared, he swept with a hot stroke of his tongue, alternating tiny love bites. His calloused hands glided up her thighs, and the delicious friction created by his rough palms against her smooth skin awakened erogenous zones she'd never known she had. Her knees trembled, and she clutched his muscled shoulders for support.
"Lovely you are,"
he purred, slipping his hands between her thighs, kneading and tasting her.
"I do not know which part of you to taste first."
"Tristan?"
she moaned, pressing against him.
"What, Gwen? Do you want me?"
"God, yes."
"Did you want me when you saw me in those blue trews?" he pushed. "Did you want me then, too?"
"Yes."
"Do you feel the heat when I touch you? Does it hit you like a thunderbolt, too?"
"Yes."
He stripped off her thong and rose to his feet. He drank in the sight of her nude body for a long moment before dragging her into his arms. They both cried out as skin met skin, stunned by the intensity of the contact, sizzling where they touched. He kissed her deeply, his tongue hot and hungry, plundering her mouth. She arched her back, rubbing her breasts against him. When he cupped his hands beneath her bottom, she clasped her hands behind his neck and wrapped her legs tightly around him, so his erection was firmly trapped in the V of her thighs. She squirmed, wanting him inside her right now. But either he wasn't cooperating, or she was too clumsy to angle them into the right position, which, she rued, given her inexperience, was possible.
"But it doesn't seem that he's being particularly helpful,"
she thought mulishly, breaking their kiss long enough to look at him. His silvery gaze was wicked, and cockily amused.
"Are you torturing me?"
"My pace, lass. You're the one who said no and wasted days. We might have done this yesterday when you stuffed me into those torturous trews, and later that afternoon, and later that night, and this morning, and—"
When she tried to reply, he kissed her so hard she forgot what she was going to say. He rocked himself against her, mimicking sex, gliding back and forth in the slick V of her thighs. Millions of tiny nerve endings screamed for more.
"Well, if he won't, I will."
She knew better than most people that forces of nature should not be resisted or subdued. She twisted against him, rubbing herself wantonly, pushing herself to the peak. As her soft panting became more frantic, Drustin broke the kiss and looked at her. Her cheeks were flushed, her eyes brilliant and wild, her lips kiss bruised and parted.
"That's it, lass. Take your pleasure."
He was riveted by her unabashed hunger for him. She was making him hotter and harder with every insistent thrust of her hips. If he wasn't careful, he'd spill without ever entering her. He doubted a woman had ever desired him so intensely. She whimpered as she came. She purred. She rubbed against him like a love-starved kitten.
"Yes,"
he breathed, flooded with purely male possessive triumph. When her shudders subsided and she relaxed against him, he lowered her to the ground on his plaid, then sat back on his knees and gazed at her for a long moment, long enough that she began to squirm, and it wrought havoc upon his fleeting control. She arched her back, raising her breasts toward him, her nipples dark berries, begging to be suckled.
"Touch me,"
she whispered.
"Ah, lass, I'll touch you,"
he promised. He nudged her legs wider, then drank in the sight of her, lying in wait for him, her full breast swollen from his kisses, her thighs open and slick with her desire. He ran his hand up the inside of her thighs, across her woman's wetness, then down the other leg, once, twice, and a half dozen times lingering between her thighs, flicking her sensitive nub until she was arching her hips up from the plaid.
"I'm going to toop yours you've not been toop before, lass."
Gwen was quite certain of that, having never been tooped before.
"Promises, promises, McKelter,"
she provoked.
"A woman could die of old age before you got around to it."
His eyes flew wide in surprise. Then he laughed, a husky laugh full of dark eroticism.
"Finally,"
she purred, when shoulder muscles bunching sleekly, he covered her body with his.
"Have you no sense at all that you would provoke me? I'm twice your size, you know,"
he murmured against her ear.
"So show me something I don't already know,"
she gasped when he nipped her earlobe.
"Like this?"
he asked, shifting himself between her thighs.
Or like this.
He rubbed the head of his cock back and forth and back again in her slick folds. Gwyn melted as he spoke to her, then in a language she'd never heard, but knew was tribute from the husky admiration in his voice. The strange accents made her wild as he purred compliments against her heated skin. She half wondered if he was ensorcelling her, because the more he spoke in his foreign accents, the hotter she got. Or perhaps it was the smoky, deep voice and the way his hands moved over every inch of her body, as if memorizing the subtleties of each plane and hollow. He devoted lavish attention to her breasts, squeezing them, plumping and fondling them until she was nearly delirious with need, hovering at the brink of another orgasm. He braced himself on his forearms and suckled each nipple, moving his head back and forth, chafing her with his shadow beard, and just when she thought one couldn't take the erotic teasing anymore, he would turn his attention to the other. He kissed her breasts, the sides of her breasts, the soft, warm place beneath them, pushed them together and kissed the plump cleavage, dragging his tongue roughly between them, then returned to her hard nipples and took them alternately with his teeth, nipping and suckling and drawing her into his mouth. She nearly screamed from the exquisite pleasure of it. He trailed kisses over her ribs, down her abdomen, then glided his tongue across her belly, playfully flickering into her belly button. Then suddenly, he dragged his tongue across her swollen bud, and she cried out.
"There's my lass,"
he purred, burying his face between her thighs.
"The man has a magic tongue," she thought, writhing beneath him.
He cupped his hands beneath her bottom, raised her to his mouth, and Gwyn filled the night with tiny whimpers as he kissed and licked her, then plunged his tongue deep inside her. As his hot tongue stroked her in places that had never been touched before, she came in spasms, and he lapped her as she shuddered over and over again. Then, just when she thought it was over, he gently nipped her, wringing a tinier series of spasms from her trembling body.
"Resonance! I am crystal and I am shattering," she thought feverishly.
As she arched her hips against him, crying out, Drustin growled and pressed himself against the ground. He wanted this to last as long as it could, wanted to pleasure her like no other man ever had. Gritting his teeth, he pressed himself against the plaid, remaining perfectly still, trying to convince his cock that it needed to wait just a bit longer, because at least he could give her this. At least he could have this. This perfect moment with her, if not else. She whimpered softly as the spasms stopped, and he gently lapped her again, playfully warning her that she would have many more peaks of pleasure before he was through with her. She was so beautiful and open to him. She was the most sensuous woman he'd ever met in his life, every inch of her body sensitive to his caresses, and although he'd bedded scores of bawdy women in his life, none had nudged him past the edge of reason until now. His stomach was shaky from the intensity of his desire, and his cock was so hard it was painful. His breathing sounded harsh to his own ears. The beat of his heart was the thunder of 100 horses. The blood boiled in his veins, and reality narrowed down to just one thing. Her. He could wait no longer. He rained kisses upon the gentle swell of her stomach, over her breasts, and dragged the edge of his teeth back and forth across her nipples. Positioning himself between her legs, he did not take her immediately, but kissed her thoroughly, a kiss of demand and dominion, of raw possession.
"Tell me," he demanded.
She didn't play shy or coy, a thing he liked. She let him read her hunger in her face, in her expressive stormy eyes, hiding nothing. But would she speak of her desire? Would she be audacious and whisper words to him that would tell him how to fulfill her wildest needs?
"Tell me," he insisted.
His wee Gwendolyn said a thing to him then that he'd never heard a woman say before, neither high-born nor whore, and the baseness of her words slammed into him as if he'd swallowed a double dose of Rome lust potion. He'd never had a woman say that to him. They used gentler words, but what Gwen had asked of him was exactly what he wanted to do. Their attraction to each other was primitive and went far beyond reason. If she could voice such raw desires, what more might she confront bravely? Who and what he was? Might she possess such courage? She lay beneath him, shivering with desire, her lips glistening in the moonlight, wet from his kisses, and he realized he was falling for her harder than a mighty oak cleaved in two by a lightning bolt would crash to the forest floor. He plunged inside her, and stopped, not by choice, oh nay, not by his choice, but because there was something in his way.
"Oh, just push," she cried. "I know it's going to hurt at first. Just do it. Get it over with."
He was stunned. Fragments of thoughts collided in his head. "She's untouched by any man. How could this woman have survived a maiden so long? Are the men in her century utter fools?" Then, she chose no other, but she chose me. What a gift. A more noble man might have backed off, a more noble man who knew that even a minute possibility existed that he might disappear that night would surely have refused. But there was something about Gwen Cassidy that drove him far past nobility. He wanted her, by fair means or foul, and if the worst happened tonight, the loving between them might make her more able to face what she may have to confront. Mayhap help her complete all the things he might need her do, and mayhap he could entertain the outlandish dream. She could be persuaded to find a happy future in his past. For like it or not, the only future she was going to have after tonight was in his past. He would make it up to her, he vowed. Her happiness would be his first priority. He would give her anything she wanted, heap her with mountains of gifts, attention and devotion, as befitted a queen. He would wait on her hand and foot, and mayhap loving could work out the uncertainties in his plan that no amount of careful and cautious orchestration could accomplish.
"I may be little," she coaxed softly when he hesitated, "but I'm tougher than you think."
And she repeated her previous request that had sent all the blood in his body rushing to his groin. Inflamed, he plunged through the barrier, claiming her.
"Yes!"
she screamed. And he drank her cry into his mouth, kissing her savagely, pushing deep within her. She matched his urgent rhythm, and although he knew it had caused her pain, her desire quickly surpassed the tearing of her maidenhead. He gave himself to her with intensity he'd not given a woman before, burying himself so deep inside her he thought he must be touching the lip of her womb, then gliding out, slowly, only to thrust again. His entire world, his every breath and heartbeat was focused on the woman in his arms. Slipping her legs over his shoulders, he angled himself to drive back into her. He took the move achingly, slowly, knowing how wee she was, and that he would stretch her to her limits. But he needed to be so deep inside her that he no longer knew where he began and she ended. He slid into her, inch by inch, his body straining from such sweet torture.
"Trustin',"
she cried, tossing her head from side to side, tangling her silky hair. He sucked her nipples as he withdrew and returned, and when he felt her contract around him, he clamped his teeth lightly on a nipple and tugged. He drove himself into her, hard and fast and deep, over and over until he was nearly mindless with savage need.
"Ach, lassie," he said roughly, caught up in her spasms. "I canna ride out of this storm again."
And as he thrust inside her so hard it nearly hurt him, his husky voice mingled with her sweet cries. They peaked in perfect rhythm, each shuddering contraction of her body drawing forth his seed. He purred to her as he came, in an ancient tongue he knew she wouldn't understand. He said foolish things, heartfelt things, deep and weighty things he could never acknowledge otherwise. He called her his goddess of the moon, and praised her courageous spirit and fire. He asked her for babies. Christ, he talked like a fool. Gwen shuddered against him, listening to his strange accents, and somehow she knew that every word he uttered was praise. When he finally stilled against her, she stroked his back and shoulders, marveling, buoyant, elated and sated beyond compare.
"You are beautiful, lass,"
he whispered, brushing his lips back and forth over hers tenderly. She squealed when he thumped inside her, a final flexing from their love play.
"Did I hurt you, sweet Gwen?"
he asked, with such concern in his eyes that it touched her heart.
"A bit,"
she confessed,
But no more than I expected after seeing that sock you have there.
He smiled, his eyes dancing.
I told you it was God-given. You would hear none of it.
He sucked her lower lip.
I didn't mean to hurt you, lass. I fear I was without sense for a time there.
No more than I. I think I said something really bad.
She worried, nibbling her lip.
It aroused me immensely. He growled. Never have I had a woman say such a thing to me, and it made me hard as stone.
You are always hard, McKeltar, she teased. Don't think I don't see that permanent bulge in your clothing.
I know, he said smugly. Your glance thrifts there often.
He sobered suddenly.
But now, I know why you were naysaying me.
Gwen,
why did you not tell me you had known no man before me?
She closed her eyes and sighed.
Ah, I was afraid you'd say no,
she finally admitted.
I wasn't sure you would make love to a virgin.
Make love, she'd said. She'd saved herself from all others, but chosen to give herself to him.
You care for me,
he thought, hoping she would say the words. He was disappointed when she didn't, but in her touch, her hands tracing gentle circles on his chest, he felt a tenderness that meant much to him. And she'd given him her maidenhead. He felt himself hardening again, moved by the depth of her gift. Although he hadn't given her proof that he was telling the truth, she'd given of herself freely to him, that which she'd given to no other man. She had feelings for him, he was sure of it, as sure as he was that Gwen Cassidy didn't give of herself lightly. She'd honored him in so many ways. There was no question in his mind. She was the one for him, the woman he'd wanted all his life. And so what if he'd had to come 500 years into the future to find her? He would give her the words and begin the druid binding, and mayhap in a few hours, if all was well, she might freely give the words back to him. And if all doesn't go well? He shrugged mentally. If all didn't go well, and he didn't survive tonight, the 16th-century version of him would find her druggingly irresistible, even before she said the spell to merge their memories. He could see no harm in that, doubted it would come to pass anyway. She'd given him a precious gift. This was all he had to offer her in return, the gift of his eternal love. He placed the palm of his right hand on her chest over her heart, the palm of his left above his, and looked deep into her eyes. When he spoke, his voice was low and firm.
If aught must be lost, 'twill be my honor for yours. If one must be forsaken, 'twill be my soul for yours. Should death come anon, 'twill be my life for yours.
He drew a deep breath and finished it, completing the spell that would haunt him for life.
I am given.
He shuddered as he felt the irrevocable bond take root within him, a bond that could never be severed. He was now connected to her by gossamer strands of awareness. Were he to walk into a room of people, he would be drawn to her side. Were he to enter a village, he would know if she was in it. Emotion welled up within him, and he struggled to hold it back, astonished by the intensity. Feelings crashed over him, feelings he'd never imagined. She was so beautiful, made 1,000 times more so by his having opened himself completely to her. Her eyes were wide.
What did you mean by that?
She asked with a shaky little laugh. He'd spoken in that strange voice again, the one that held the resonance of 1,000 voices, the soft rumble of spring thunder. It had sounded terribly romantic, a little serious and scary, too. His words had been almost like a living thing, brushing her with warm fingers. She had a nagging sensation that there was something she should say back to him, but had no idea what or why. He smiled enigmatically.
Oh, I get it. It's another one of those things.
That will become clear in time.
He finished for her.
Aye, It's rather like, I will protect you should the need ever arise. It's more like, you are mine forever, should you agree and give me the words back. And now I am yours forever, whether you agree or not, he thought. It was a risky thing he'd just done, of a certain, because if she never agreed, Drustan McKelter would ache endlessly for her. His heart, trapped by the binding spell, he would sense her eternally, would love her eternally. But should she one day choose to freely give the words back, the bond would intensify a thousandfold. He could live for such a hope. Her eyes widened further when she felt him stiffen inside her.
Again?
Are you too tender? He asked gently. She arched a brow.
I told you. I'm tougher than you think, she said, running the tip of her pink tongue over her lower lip.
He groaned and caught it between his lips. Then, aye, lass, and again, he said as he began to glide back and forth inside her. We McKelters were bred for stamina. And since he knew she was the disbelieving type, a woman disinclined to accept anything but firm proof, he proceeded to give her hard evidence of his claim, telling her with his body all the words he so longed to say. September 21st, 3 minutes to midnight. Chapter 10. Gwyn stretched languorously, her hands skimming the muscles of Drustan's back. She felt sleepily sated and sexy and tender and, oh, so much more complex than she had before. She felt brand new somehow. Gwyn Cassidy had finally been well and truly plucked. An indefinable sense of peace and rightness nestled in her belly. Her heart was full, her mind at ease. But breathing beneath his weight was a challenge even the new and improved Gwyn wasn't up to, so with a gentle nudge, she eased him off her. He rolled onto his back, and she slipped astride him, straddling him the same way she had the day she'd found him, but with one highly erotic and delightful difference. They were both nude. There was so much she wanted to do with him. She wanted to make love on top of him, beside him, with him behind her.
Drustan,
she murmured, studying his face, so beautiful in the silvery light of the moon. His eyes opened, hot metal silver, lazily seductive.
Thank you,
she said softly. He'd made her first time a beautiful, passionate, intense experience, and if for some unfathomable reason she never got to make love with him again, she knew he would be the standard by which she judged men for the rest of her life. She was falling head over heels in love, and it felt incredible. He caught her face in his hands and pulled her down for a hungry kiss. Never thank me, lass. Only ask me for more. That's the finest praise a man can hear from a woman. That, and this. He slipped a hand between her legs. Woman's due that tells a man how much she desires him. He smiled at her, and at precisely the same moment noticed the carriage of the moon in the sky. His smile faded abruptly, and his body tensed beneath hers. The passion receded from his eyes, replaced by panic. Christ! He swore. "'Tis nearly too late!" Rolling her off him, he leaped to his feet, grabbed his plaid, and raced to the stone slab. "'Come!' he commanded. Befuddled by her rapid dismount, still feeling sexy and sleepy and soft, she stared blankly at him. "'Tis nearly midnight!' he said urgently. "'Come!' She reached for her clothing, and he snapped, "'No time to dress, but you must bring your pack, Gwyn!' Puzzled by his comment, and not completely comfortable with her nudity, she grabbed her backpack and hurried to join him at the slab nevertheless, the scientist within her intensely curious to discover how he planned to prove his claims true. Besides, she told herself, there would be time for more lovemaking afterward. He worked swiftly, stealing intermittent glances at the sky as he dipped his fingers in the paint and sketched the final symbols on the slab. "Take my hand." She slipped her hand into his. He studied the designs a moment, then shook his head and exhaled loudly. Ah, pray, Amrigin, let them be right. Stand close to me, Gwyn, here. Gwyn positioned herself where he indicated,
and tried to peer around him to see the last symbols, but he angled his body between them, blocking her view.
"What do you think is going to happen, Tristan?"
she asked, glancing at her watch, surprised that anything had remained on her body in the frenzy of their lovemaking. She nearly laughed when she realized that it, and the strap of the pack over her shoulder, were all she now wore. The second hand moved with an audible tick, tick, tick.
"Gwen, I..."
He broke off and looked at her. Her gaze flew to his. Had he felt it too when they'd made love? Being inexperienced in lovemaking, she was uncertain if the emotion she felt when she looked at him was a temporary side effect of physical intimacy. She suspected it was of more significant duration, but wasn't in any hurry to make a fool of herself. But if he was feeling it too, she might believe that what existed between them was every bit as real and valid as any mathematical equation. His gaze swept over her body in such a way that he made her feel beautiful, not short and, all right, a little plump. She'd always felt inadequate in a world that plastered leggy, slim cover models on every magazine and in every movie. But not with him. In his eyes, she saw a reflection of herself that was perfection.
"Would that we had an eternity,"
he said sadly. Her fingers tightened around his hand, silently encouraging him to continue. When her watch chimed the hour of midnight with tiny metallic tings, she flinched. 1, 2, 3.
"You are magnificent, lass,"
he said, tracing a finger down the curve of her cheek.
"Such a fearless heart."
5, 6, 7.
"Have you come to care for me, if only a bit, Gwen?"
Gwen nodded, her throat suddenly thick, not trusting herself to speak. He looked so sad that she was afraid she might blurt out silly, sentimental things and make a fool of herself. She'd already said one thing during their lovemaking she'd never thought would slip past her lips, and now, if she wasn't careful, she'd get disgustingly mushy on him.
9.
"That, and my faith in you, must be enough. Would you aid me were I in danger?"
"Of course,"
she said instantly. Then, more hesitantly,
"What about me?"
"My life for you," he said simply. "Lass, dunna fear me. No matter what happens, promise me you will not fear me. I am a good man. I vow I am."
Stricken by the pain in his voice, she brushed his jaw with her fingers.
"I know you are, Justin McKelter,"
she said firmly.
"I don't fear you."
"But things might change."
"Nothing can change that. Nothing could make me fear you."
"Would that it could be true,"
he said, his eyes dark. 12.
13?
He cried out then, dragged her roughly into his arms, and kissed her, a deep soul kiss, and the world as Gwen Cassidy knew it began to unravel at the seams. She began gyrating in his arms, bobbing and spinning like a cork in a whirlpool, up and down, side to side, back and forward, then a new direction that wasn't a direction at all. Space-time shifted, her very existence within it changed, and somehow she melted from Drustin's arms. Her backpack slipped from her shoulder and went sailing off into a vortex of light. As if from a great distance, she saw her hands reaching for it, but there was something wrong with them. They had an added dimension her mind couldn't comprehend. She wiggled her fingers, struggling to grasp their new quality. Her palms, her wrists, her arms were so different. She thought she saw Drustin spinning past, and then she thought she heard a distant sonic boom, but a sonic boom would have meant that she was moving faster than the speed of sound, and she wasn't moving at all, unless one counted the fact that she felt as ineffectual as a butterfly batting fragile wings against the gale-force winds of a tornado. She fancied she could feel the tips of those delicate appendages tearing off. Besides, she thought dimly, struggling for some core of sanity, the person moving faster than the speed of sound didn't hear the sonic boom. Only those standing still did. Then a flash of white encompassed her, so blinding that she lost all sense of time and space and self. Whiteness filled her. She choked on it, breathed it, felt it beneath her skin, soaking into her cells and rearranging them according to some alien design. Terminal velocity for the average skydiver, the scientist within her recited in a chilly voice. Averages 93 to 125 miles per hour. Sound travels 760 miles per hour on a humid day. Escape velocity is the speed required to exit the Earth's atmosphere and achieve interplanetary travel, or 25,000 miles per hour. Light travels 186,000 miles per second. Then the peculiar thought. A cat always lands on its feet. Maintain an angular momentum of zero. There was no sense of motion, yet there was a horrible vertigo. There was no sound, yet the silence was deafening. There was no fullness of body, yet there was no emptiness. Escape velocity achieved and exceeded. White and whiter. She was in, on, off a long bridge or tunnel. She had no body to instruct to run. The white was gone so abruptly that the darkness hit her like a brick wall. Then there was blessed sight and sound and feeling in her hands and feet. Maybe not so blessed, she decided. Taste was a bitter metallic bile in the back of her throat. Weight was a sickening pressure after the terrible vacuum. Stifling the urge to vomit, she lifted a head that weighed 2 tons and felt as swollen as an overripe tomato. Around her, the night exploded. Driving hail pelted the ground, gouging tendrils of mist from the soil. The wind wailed and keened, flung leaves and snapped branches. Large chunks of ice stung her bare skin.
"Trustin!"
she cried.
"Here, lass."
He stumbled to her side, then slipped on the hail-covered terrain and fell to his knees.
"Trustin, what's happening?"
As he drew himself erect, she saw that his face was pale and drawn. Lines she'd never noticed before etched sharp grooves around his mouth. He was looking down at his hands with horror. Her gaze flew to them, wondering what was wrong with them. Whatever he saw, she couldn't see. They seemed to disappear into the mist.
"I erred when I sketched the final symbols," he yelled hoarsely.
A large ball of ice struck his cheekbone, raising an immediate welt.
"I went back too far. I thought I could come with you, but I cannot. Forgive me, lass, it wasn't supposed to be this way."
"What?"
Gwyn could scarcely hear him, so deafening was the wind. Strands of her hair stung the skin of her neck as the wind whipped it wildly about her face. The gale was so lashing it felt as if it was raking the skin from her cheekbones. The hail was bruising her scalp. Her head ached in dozens of spots. She inched toward him and clutched at his arm. It felt curiously insubstantial beneath her fingers, although she could see the muscles in his arms bulging. He tried to close his misty hand around hers, but it sort of slid through hers.
"What's happening to you?"
she wailed.
"Save me! Save my clan, lass!" he yelled. "Keep the lore safe!"
Christ, he could feel himself being torn in two. Talking to her, simultaneously trying to reason with his past self. It wasn't working. It took immense effort merely to move his lips and form words. He was coming apart, 2 places in 1 time, and all the while reeling because he finally understood the next dimension. And he had to tell her what to say and do. He must tell her how to use the spell he'd taught her.
"What are you talking about?"
she cried.
"Ouch!"
she cried as a chunk of hail struck her forehead. But he didn't answer, just flickered in a way that terrified her, as if he was fading, but fighting to stay. Nearly hysterical, Gwyn tried to cling to him, but he slid through her hands. His silver eyes flashed. He looked wild, forbidding, a dark sorcerer from eons past. He thrust his plaid at her, wordlessly demanding she take it. She closed trembling fingers over the fabric.
"Listen!"
he cried. His gaze swept over her and passion blazed in his eyes. Then he cocked his head as if hearing something she couldn't hear, and glanced beyond her as if seeing something she couldn't see. His lips moved 1 last time.
"The moment you see him, you must tell him. Show him."
"What?"
she cried.
"Tell who what?"
Flying leaves and limbs rained down upon them. When he ducked and shielded his face to avert a blow from a particularly large branch, she missed most of what he was saying. Tell and show who what? Abruptly, he was gone. vanished as completely as the symbols had vanished from his chest in the cave days ago. With his disappearance, the maelstrom died, and the hail ceased abruptly. The night fell silent. The mist dissipated on a last bitter gust of wind. Gwyn remained frozen in shock, bruised and wind-burned and aching. She didn't trust herself to take even one step on a leg that moments ago had not been her leg at all, but her leg and something else, something the bristling scientist was still pacing back and forth in a white lab coat, protesting stridently. She wasn't certain any part of her would obey simple orders, so knotted up was her mind.
"Trustin',"
she called weakly. Then, louder,
"Trustin'!"
A terrible silence greeted her. She shivered uncontrollably, belatedly remembering she was nude. Woodenly, she pulled his plaid around her and scrambled across the slippery ground toward the fire. But there was no fire. The storm must have put it out. She dropped to her knees on the hail-covered ground, clutching his plaid, huddling within it for warmth. Dazedly, she glanced about and was astonished to see the hail was so thick on the ground that it looked as if the heavens had opened up and simply iced the top of the mountain. It could take hours for it to melt in the warm autumn night. And then she fell still and thought no more about the strange storm, as she replayed their entire encounter through her mind, finally seeing the pattern. He had said he would prove to her that he was telling the truth, but he could only do it at the stones. He'd said that if she didn't believe him, she would be free of him. She now realized he'd always chosen his words cautiously, couching double meanings. Now she understood exactly what he'd meant.
"You left me,"
she whispered.
"You really showed me, huh?"
She snorted and started crying at the same time.
"Incontrovertible proof! Uh-huh, ever the doubter here, that's me!"
He'd bullied her into guiding him through her time to the stones, made incredible love to her, proved his story true, then returned himself to his own time, leaving her in the 21st century, alone. He hadn't been deranged after all. She'd had a genuine time-traveling 16th century warrior in her arms, and she mocked him at every turn, treated him with disbelief, even patronized him on occasion. Oh, she'd screwed this one up royally. She'd fallen for him at terminal velocity. In the space of 3 days, she'd grown attached to him as she'd never thought possible. She'd been building a life with him in her mind, rationalizing away his delusions, weaving him into her world. And he'd left her. He'd not even offered to take her with him.
"Would you have gone? Would you have said yes?"
the scientist asked dryly.
"Plunged into a century you knew nothing about, left this one behind for good?" "Hell yes, I would have said yes. What do I have here? I was falling in love and I'd go anywhere, do anything for that."
For a novel change, the scientist within her had no caustic comeback. Gwen cried, feeling suddenly old, regretting the loss of a thing she'd not truly appreciated and understood while she'd held it in her hand. She had no idea how long she lay in the clearing, replaying things through her mind, lingering over their lovemaking, seeing everything in a different light. When she finally sat up, she was trembling. Her knees were frozen from huddling on the ice, and her toes were stinging.
"I feel, McKelter. You taught me that. I hope you're happy with yourself showing me I had a heart by hurting me."
She pushed herself up and slipped around the circle, searching for her clothes in the dark. Shaking off a fresh desire to weep, she blew out a breath. Where the hell were her boots? For that matter, where were her backpack and her flashlight? She was starting to suffer a severe nicotine craving. Emotional distress always made her crave a cigarette. How was she ever going to get over him? How would she cope with the knowledge that the man she'd lost her heart to had been dead for hundreds of years? Panic gripped her as she circled the stone slab, searching for her belongings. They were gone. Could the freakish and violent windstorm have carried it all off? Stunned, she glanced about, then up at the sky and caught a glimpse, for the first time since Drustin had disappeared, of what lay beyond the stones. Where previously there had been nothing, Tons upon tons of stone rose up from the earth. She gaped in astonishment, her gaze drifting from tower to turret, to bigger stone tower, past walls capped by those toothy stone things one saw on castles everywhere in Scotland, and to yet another turret and a square tower again. Blinking, she looked left to right and back again. An alarm went off in her brain, but she couldn't respond to it. She couldn't respond to anything. She started hyperventilating. Tiny breaths slammed into each other and piled up in her throat. A monstrous castle lay beyond the circle of stones. Huge, forbidding, yet beautiful. It was fashioned of massive gray stone walls that vaulted smoothly skyward. A center rectangular tower stood tallest, and had two smaller round towers flanking it. Wings spread east to west, consuming the horizon, with large square towers at the farthest east and west ends. A milky fog dusted the ridges and capped the turrets. Her jaw dropped. Still as the cold stones that encircled her, she stared. Could it be that she had not lost him, after all? With a painful surge of adrenaline that made her heart beat much too fast, she bolted from the circle of stones and burst into a terraced courtyard. Pathways forked in various directions, one leading straight to the front steps of the castle itself. She spun in a slow circle, heedless of her icy toes. Dimly, her mind registered the fact that the hail had fallen only within the circle of stones. The ground beyond it was warm and dry. He'd told her that in his century, the stones of Ban Drocaid had been enclosed within the perimeter walls of his estate. But the Ban Drocaid she'd entered an hour ago had resided in the midst of a wasteland of crumbled stone and grass. Yet now, she was completely encircled by high walls, within a veritable fortress. She glanced at the night sky. It was dense black, with no distant glow on the horizon in any direction, which was impossible, because Alborath lay in the valley beyond. And only last night, while sitting on the hood of the rental car, she'd rued that the lights of the village spoiled her view of the stars. Turning back to the castle that hadn't been there 5 minutes ago, she fingered the folds of his plaid. Suddenly, the words he'd shouted, words she'd ignored because they hadn't made any sense at the time, now made perfect sense.
"I went back too far. I thought I could come with you, but I cannot. Save my clan."
"Oh, God, Druston," she thought. "You didn't go back in time. You sent me back to save you."
When I consider the small span of my life absorbed in the eternity of all time, or the small part of space which I can touch or see engulfed by the infinite immensity of spaces that I know not and that know me not, I am frightened and astonished to see myself here instead of there, now instead of then. Blaise Pascal. For those of us who believe in physics, this separation between past, present, and future is only an illusion, however tenacious. Albert Einstein. July 18th, 1518. Chapter 11. The nightmare was beyond anything Druston McKeltar's slumbering mind had ever managed to conjure, replete with a taste so vile he knew it for what it was, the taste of death. Shadowy images taunted him at the periphery of his vision, and he felt a monstrous leech suckle onto him, and they grappled. Then suddenly, there were two discreet yet similar beings inside his body.
"I am possessed of a demon,"
the sleeping Druston thought, struggling to spew the atrocity forth.
"I will not permit this."
Enraged, he resisted the new presence violently, lashing out to destroy it without even trying to identify it. It was foreign and as strong as he was, and that was all he needed to know. He focused his mind, isolating the intruder, cocooning it with his will, and with immense effort thrust it from his body. Then, suddenly, there were two of him in his nightmare. But the other him looked older and anguished, mortally weary.
"Get thee hence, devil!"
Druston shouted.
"Listen to me, you fool!"
Druston clamped his hands over his ears.
"I will hear none of your lies, demon!"
Somewhere in the distance, in the nightmare place that defied his mind's ability to either comprehend or fabricate, Drustin scented a woman. She was indistinct, but he could feel her, even smell the fragrant heat of her skin. A rush of longing consumed him, nearly shattering his resolve to hold the other him at bay. Sensing the weakness, the replica leaped forward, but Drustin flexed his will and knocked him aside. They glared at each other, and Drustin wondered at the play of emotions on the replica's face. Fear. Sorrow so deep it might cleave a man asunder. And as he watched, a sudden understanding flickered in the false Drustin's eyes, even as the replica seemed to be losing solidity.
"You would fight me to the death."
The counterfeit's lips moved soundlessly.
"I see. I see now why only one lives. 'Tis not nature which is innately indifferent, but our own fear that causes us to destroy each other. I beg you, accept me. Let us both be." "I will never accept you!"
Drustin roared. The replica faded, then grew more solid, then faded around the edges again.
"You are in terrible danger! Speak no more! I will believe naught you say!"
Drustin lashed out at the shadow him viciously. The shadow him glanced over his shoulder and shouted to someone Drustin couldn't see.
"The moment you see him, you must tell him the first rhyme I taught you. Remember it? The verse in the car, and show him the backpack, and all will be well." "Be gone, demon!"
Drustin roared, shoving at him with his will. The other him speared Drustin with his gaze.
"Love her,"
the counterfeit whispered, and then he vanished. Drustin shot bolt upright in bed, gasping for air. He clawed at his throat, pounded his fists on his chest, and finally managed to suck in a painful breath. He was sweating, icy and feverish at the same time. He'd shredded his linens in his sleep. Previously soft animal skins were now mere tufts of sweat-slicked fur, and his head pounded. He fumbled for the mug of wine at his bedside. It took him several attempts before he succeeded in wrapping his fingers securely around it. Trembling, he drank deep until the mug was empty. He dragged the back of his hand across his mouth. His heart thundered, and he felt as if he'd just been more bitterly threatened than ever in his life, as if something had crept into his body and tried to claim territorial rights. He plunged shaking hands into his hair, lunged from the bed, and began to pace. He glanced back at the bed warily, expecting a succubus to be lurking in the pile of destroyed linens.
By Hammergen, what strange dream had been visited upon him!
He could recall naught of it now but a bitter sense of violation and a hollow sense of victory. His attention was snared by a brilliant flash of light beyond the window of his bedchamber. A low growl of thunder followed it, and he tugged aside the tapestry and gazed out through the glass into the night. Drustin stood by the window for a long time, taking slow, deep breaths and trying to regain a measure of calm. He rarely suffered nightmares, and preferred to forget this one, for the dream reeked of madness. He firmly corralled it in a deep, dark place in his mind, burying it where it would never see the light of day. The storm died as suddenly as it had arisen, and the Highland night fell still and silent again.
"Think, think, think,"
Gwyn berated herself.
"You're supposed to be so brainy, use it."
But her brain felt numb and clumsy. After the day she'd just had, the incredible passion, the bizarre storm, the fuzziness of her mind from nicotine withdrawal, she was in no condition to be brilliant. She was hardly in any condition to manage average. Pacing gingerly upon the melting hail, she tallied the tangible facts, because the intangible ones, at the moment, scared the bejesus out of her. She was desperate to find some factual, logical conclusion to explain away the illogic of her whereabouts. She shivered, eyeing the castle. The prospect of confronting what it held both fascinated and terrified her. But there was something she had to do first. Not that she was the disbelieving type, no way, not her. But she did prefer to view hard evidence with her own two eyes. Drawing a bracing breath, she plunged into the darkness beyond the circle and sped away from the castle. When she reached the estate wall, she flung herself up on a pile of casks, pressed her cheek to a narrow slit in the wall, and peered out into the valley at the city of Alboreth. It wasn't there. Suspicion confirmed. Her shoulders slumped. She hadn't expected it to be, but its absence was shocking nonetheless.
I went back too far.
In other words, she mused, sorting through what she knew about the theories of time travel, he'd probably tried to go back to shortly after he'd been abducted, but had gotten the symbols wrong. He'd returned to a time when the past him was there in the castle, and common theory held that if time travel were possible, the fabric of the universe would not suffer two identical selves in a single moment. The future him had somehow been cancelled out.
Time travel!
The scientist shouted in her head.
Analyze! We have to save him. Analyze that. We'll contemplate the ramifications of multiverses later.
If the future him had been cancelled out, that meant the Drustan she'd fallen in love with no longer existed. But she would find him in the castle, pre-enchantment, and with no knowledge of her whatsoever. That thought made her heart hurt. She was in no rush to look into his silvery eyes, which had gazed at her so intimately but an hour ago, and see an utter lack of recognition.
Promise me you will not fear me.
Fear him? Why would she have feared him? Because he could manipulate time? Sheesh, that only increased her fascination with him.
Save my clan.
She would not fail him. Squaring her shoulders, she hurried back through the stones toward the castle and flew up the stairs. Fisting her hand, she knocked on an enormous door that made her feel like a shrunken Alice in a hostile wonderland. Once, twice, and again.
Hello? Hello?
She cried. She flung her small frame at it, pounding with her shoulder. There was no answer. No convenient doorbell, either. Her mind duly noted more tangible evidence that what she was knocking on was not a 21st-century door. She would contemplate the medieval door later, from the inside. At the moment, she was feeling as if she might faint at any moment. The strangeness of it all left her feeling utterly overwhelmed. And so what if she was a physicist, supposedly capable of heightened comprehension? She was totally freaked out.
Oh, please!
She cried, turning around and using her bottom as a battering ram on the thick door. Thump, thump. Thump, thump. It hurt her more than it hurt the door, and made about as much noise as a downy pillow. She'd be damned if she was getting sent back to save him, only to be denied entrance. She stepped back and eyed the windows. Perhaps she could toss something through the glass. Not exactly a wise way to petition shelter from strangers, she decided. Someone might shoot at her. Arrows or something equally archaic. Perhaps toss boiling oil down the walls. She cast a glance about and spied a pile of chopped wood. She scurried over to it, freed a wedge, and slammed one end against the door.
Please open up!
She called.
I'm coming!
A sleepy voice replied.
I heard you the first time! Impatient, aren't you?
There was the sound of metal sliding against wood, and the door was finally, blessedly opened. Gwyn sank to her knees with relief. A buxom 40-ish woman clad in a long gown and lacy cap stood in the doorway, blinking sleep from her eyes. Her eyes widened as she took in the sight huddling on the doorstep, nearly naked. She whisked Gwyn through the door with a strong grip and slammed it behind them.
"Oh, glassy,"
she crooned, gathering her in her arms.
"Nell's got ye now. For the love of Columba, what gives ye cause to be wandering so on such a night? An English wench, no less. How came ye here? Did a man have at ye? Did he harm ye, wee lass?"
As the woman drew her to her ample bosom, Gwyn thought, "So this is Drustan's Nell," and sagged against her. She was exactly as he described, assertive and gruffly kind, pretty, past the flush of youth, but with a timeless beauty that would never fade. Beyond coherent thought, she was dimly astonished to realize her brain was shutting off, as if someone had flipped the main breaker and, circuit by circuit, all systems were going down. She couldn't crash now. She needed to know what date it was. But her body, overwhelmed and madly off-kilter from her jaunt through the centuries, had other ideas.
"Nell, what's all the commotion?"
A man called from somewhere in the perimeter of her awareness.
Help me with the lass, Sylvan,
Nell murmured.
'Tis the oddest thing, but she's chilled and her feet are near frozen.
Gwyn tried desperately to ask, What's the date, and is he okay? But damn it all, she was passing out. Her fading consciousness chuckled richly when she thought she glimpsed Albert Einstein, the greatest theoretical physicist of all time, bending over her, wiry white hair and wrinkled impish face, a mischievous light in his eyes. If she was dying, she was going to be in fine company indeed. He bent his face close to hers, and she managed to whisper,
Drustin.
Fascinating, she thought she heard him remark. Let's get her warmed up and put her in the silver chamber.
But that chamber adjoins Drustin's,
Nell protested.
'Tis not proper.
Propriety be damned. 'Tis the most suitable.
Gwyn didn't listen further. Drustin was alive and they were putting her near him. She would rest for a moment. The next morning. Chapter 12.
Why must you live all the way up here, Sylvan? You're like the bald eagle nesting on the mount,
Nell said, nudging open the door to his tower chamber, 103 steps above the castle property.